So you said there was a budget.
Today, this morning. Okay. Yep.
How's that looking? Have they got any money? Can we borrow some?
Actually, again, it's one of the strange places, but actually, things look pretty good. I mean, the budget was. I mean, I would put it as a kind of. Which I think generally is good things when budgets are non-events. It was very much a non-event. They are trying to do things that has been a little bit of a bubble in smaller mid-caps, but been sort of a little bit more short-termism in options and futures markets. So they're trying to do a little bit to curb those kind of things. Which I think this budget increasing... The main thing is increasing capital gains tax on short and long-term investments.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
To what level?
Now you're challenging me. So yeah, I think from 10 to 12 and a half.
Okay, not like 30 to 40 then.
No.
Or 20 to 40 is ours.
I'm not talking about that easy.
No, it steps. So I think they're trying to signal that, you know, we're aware that there's some market froth here, and we want there to be an orderly market environment. Mm. And if we see sort of excesses, then we're gonna step in.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that was the main thing, to be honest. I think the rest of it is, as I said, business as usual, which I think is good, because the last two terms of this government have been kind of, I would say, ramping up to what I think is going to be probably the economic reset for India for the next acceleration for the next 5 years. Mm.
And have the politics been like populist at all, like we've had in the West, or is it being, because the election was something of a surprise?
The election was a surprise. It's strange. It was a surprise because actually the outcome, considering that no other PM has been able to manage three terms in India, it's like the remarkability that actually Modi's still back as a third term PM. And I mean, in the UK, in one term we had, what was it, 5 PM. So I mean, yeah, it's a pretty good outcome that in one economy you can get a PM for three terms, which is democratically elected.
Yeah,
but it was, I mean, yes, it was a bit of a surprise that the BJP didn't get a majority. I think in hindsight, when you look back and go, India's always been anti-incumbency bias market. So they didn't get the single majority, but they've got a BJP-led coalition. So I think, and again, if you look at the ministries, actually most of the important ministries have gone back. All the important ministries have gone into BJP hands. So actually what's going to happen and drive the market is going to be led by what the government wanted previously.
Cool. Right. Well, we've got plenty to talk about, haven't we?
I think I might have just done it all. I don't know what's left.
We'll start again. Thanks for not wearing a tie, Husey, by the way.
No, I'm not. Not back today.
From holiday, so
I wanted to show off my tanned arms.
Tan. Nice one.
Some sun snuck through the.
Well, welcome back, anyway, through the shade. We've missed you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good to go. Good. Right, we'll make a start then. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 34. Delighted to be joined by Amit Mehta. Amit is the managing director at JP Morgan Asset Management and a portfolio manager within the Emerging Markets and Asia Pacific Equities team, with responsibility for the JP Morgan Indian Investment Trust. An employee since 2011, Amit previously had spells at Prusik Investment Management and Atlantis Investment Management. And prior to that, he was a global emerging markets analyst at Aviva Investors. Amit obtained a BSc in mathematics from King's College London and is a CFA charter holder. Welcome to the CFA Club. Amit, good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for coming along.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and should we sort of start with the politics? We just sort of touched on it before we got going. But obviously we had an election a few months ago, something of a surprise, but not, you know, catastrophic surprise, I suppose, you know, nasty surprise. And what is the sort of, do you want to give us sort of a bit of a rundown of what's happening in India from a political standpoint? Because obviously that's, you know, been on everyone's lips for this year. 50% of the world's population go to the polls, including India. So why don't you just give us a sort of bit of intro about that, and then we'll kind of move on to the macro and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you very much for having me. So look, I think the last, I guess, 9-12 months in India has been all, I mean, it's all been kind of election fever and everybody talking about potential outcomes. I think over the period that the election and the polls and then the elections, it was a rise in sort of market volatility, and actually as you've come through the other side of it, it's kind of business as usual. But the reality was, yeah, absolutely, it was a bit of a surprise when you kind of look back and think about what's happened happened and what the previous terms had looked like. In a sense, it shouldn't have been too much of a surprise, though. So the BJP's has been in power for the last two terms. Mm-hmm. India, like a lot of markets, has a natural anti-incumbency bias. So the idea that they'd got two complete terms and then coming into the third term, the expectation was they'd come back as another majority. So they didn't. I think that was the surprise. Though, again, as I said, you know, the market has a natural anti-incumbency bias towards it. So they've still come back with a BJP-led coalition. So in our view, that just represents more, in a sense, continuity, but a little bit more checks and balances. Mm. So there'll be an element that's a bit more populist. But the most important thing, and when we look at the key ministries in the market, have all still remained, or at least in the majority have remained, with the BJP. And why that's important is that, in a sense, it just means that you should expect economic continuity. Mm. And that's been the real positive of the, you know, the last two terms of the BJP government.
Cool. And we've got a chart on Indian GDP growth here, actually. And one of the fascinating things about India in comparison to most countries of the world is that it is growing very strongly. And yes, you've had a blip there in 2021, which was pandemic related.
Yep.
But, you know, what's that? I can eyeball the chart. Average growth rates last 10 years, probably the best part of 6-7%. And estimates are some pretty reasonable, and presumably part of that is the sort of the demographics and the population. Where is the, you know, what are the sort of big picture demographics for India these days? Over a billion people growing at something or other.
Yeah, you're kind of just about 40% off there as well in terms of the population. We're nearly 1.4 billion now.
Right?
Yeah. I think big population, we all know that anyway. As you rightly pointed out, look, economic growth has been north and around 6%. That's in real terms. So nominal terms, it's been double digits. I mean, there's no other economy around the world that's going close to that. And actually, in the last quarter, India economically grew just above 8%. There's going to be a little bit up and down within that. I think internally, our view is that you've got an economy that should grow 6-7% for the foreseeable future. And if anything, assuming there's no external internal shocks, that actually there'll be probably an acceleration through this government in terms of economic growth and driven by more of the infrastructure investment side than has been in the prior two terms. So, look, I think we're in a, from a market perspective and an economic perspective, I think we're in very good shape. And I think there was quite a lot of political literature that I read prior to these elections, which actually just said, and the election outcome is done now, so it doesn't matter. But actually it said that it didn't really matter over the last, 30 years, there might have been 10 different governments. It didn't really matter. Every government and every economic cycle saw India grow around 6% real. So I think that's it's a good position to start with, that we think we're going to grow at the same rate.
Mm. And then we've got a couple of other charts here just on the sort of the macro. So we've got UK government borrowing costs around 7%, and that's somewhat lower than its average the last 10 years. And the right-hand side here, we've got inflation in blue, CPI running at around about 5-6%. And again, that's very much in line with where it's been for the last 10 years, COVID notwithstanding. So, you know, you'd say if you look at that from a, you know, if you're a Martian looking down, I suppose, yeah, growth at 7%, population's growing, inflation is low and is what, mid-single digit and steady, and bond yields are pretty respectable. That's a pretty good cocktail list of ingredients, right, I guess, for some good outcomes.
Yeah, so I think, and I'm always wary of saying things like this, but the stars are very much aligned at the macro level. So yes, yields are actually been coming down, and obviously that helps because obviously, you know, the government wants to keep borrowing costs manageable. Mm-hmm. But the thing that determines that, as you rightly said, is the right hand chart, which is inflation. Mm. And India's been, I guess, the one risk it's always had, that it's been a highly inflationary country, and which has obviously been some pressure on the currency side of it. But actually, again, the central bank's been extremely solid around how it's managed all of those inflationary pressures. It's not tried to loosen, and it's been able to, if it wanted to, reduce rates earlier, but it's been quite cautious around that. They've set a sort of a lower end at 4.5% as RBI targets and inflation. So we're getting close to that. So if the Indian economy requires stimulus, if we start seeing rates around the world start coming down, they can do it. I don't think they're in a particular hurry. They don't need to stimulate the economy, but if they needed to, they've got plenty of bullets to be able to fire.
Good. If we sort of move on to the market, I'm going to pull a few charts out of Datastream to have a quick look at here. But, you know, if we compare India versus the rest of emerging markets, so India, total return here, 15 years, in blue. And then we've got emerging markets, general emerging markets in yellow, and China. I've just put China on there for comparison's sake. You know, emerging markets in general dominated by China in terms of the proportion. You know, India has clearly been the standout performer, not least in the last 5 years, not least in the last 2 years. What's driven the market, particularly in the last 2 years? I mean, you sort of talk around a little bit of that for us.
Yeah, so I would say there's a few things. And if I put sort of an EM hat on, I think there's been definitely a reallocation from foreign investors between the other big economy, being China. And for obvious reasons, there's been a lot more both geopolitical, political, domestic slowdown risks associated with investing in China. And at the same time, I think India's managed to actually economically do well on aspects we've already talked about, sort of in terms of rates, inflation, growth. So it's been able to garner a lot more interest, but also it's been able to re-accelerate growth on the economic side and investment side. And then it's become a safe haven, a hiding place for investors, not want to take kind of big political risks in other parts of EM. So from an EM perspective, it's been a standout place to go. From a domestic, from a purely market perspective, you've also seen big increase in domestic liquidity. Mm-hmm. And that's been a real driver. So it's not just been about foreigners' reallocation, it's actually been more and more domestic and retail investors.
Has there been sort of liberalisation in the markets, and is there a sort of core Indian middle class who are becoming investors and sort of savings and things? Is that happening?
Yeah, I mean, that is happening. There is in India, there's something called the SIPs, which are statutory investment plans, which essentially have recurring money going semi-automatically invested into the market. And, you know, most monthly run rates are around $2 billion or of that magnitude. So as much as the market used to be very much driven by what foreigners were doing, you know, in and out, actually it's been overtaken by what the domestic markets are doing or domestic investors are doing. And that continues to show that actually there's still pretty positive inclination towards the domestic market. And actually that's better supported for long-term trends. And the other thing that's happened, and I guess coincidentally because of what's happened in the market, is the proportion or the percentage that India represents, for, again, with an EM hat on. 2 years ago, India was only 8% of the EM benchmark.
Okay.
It's closing on around 20%
It's 20% of EM.
Close to, it's just under, roughly 19. So that's a pretty big change over a small period of time. So even for those that either were underweight or were trying to mark themselves something neutral, you had to gradually increase your own exposure to that market as it's done well. So,
and what's India getting so right? Because it's often compared to China, and obviously the performance has been so different, so stark over the last couple of years. Yep. What do you think China's? I know you're focused on India, but what's China got so wrong versus India getting so right? And do you think that can, you know, do you think that can carry on? Because it'll be very easy to sit here to say, you know, it'd be easy to look at that chart and say, well, India's had its time. It's time for a reversal. There's going to be a change in fortunes.
Yeah.
You know, what would be the argument against that?
Yes, and we'll talk a bit about sort of markets and valuations in a moment. But I think the first thing is, you don't want to focus too much on what other economies have got wrong. But I'd say if you start with the kind of diverging trends, firstly, India's kind of produced stock market returns very much in line with economic returns. So there's been quite a high correlation between economic growth rates and market returns. China's been kind of the opposite. And a lot of that's been to do with, I think if you look back, China's been very much an investment-led economy. So they, I guess, pulled forward a lot of investment. Yeah. And now they're having to kind of go through digesting of it. And they're trying to reorientate the economy, which is going through a slowdown, to much more of a consumer-led economy. And that's not easy to do. And you can't do it in the same way that you drove the infrastructure side. So I think they've got their... Rather than what's India done right and China got wrong, I think they're going through different parts of their own economic and growth cycles. I think China's got a bit more of a challenging period ahead of it. But there'll always be, I guess, even in that, opportunities to find stocks.
Yeah.
India's on the other side of it, actually, where actually it's done certain things very well. And I think, in a sense, you have to put some of that, or a lot of that, at the footsteps of the government, really. Since the BJP came in its first term, it kind of started with the cleanup exercise. And I always, you might have heard me talk about this, but I always talk a lot about what's happening in India is kind of building a house. You've got to put the foundations in place first. So the first term was all about that, right? It was all about starting to put the foundations in place, clean up some of the bureaucracy and the corruption and all of those things that we all know that occurs in emerging markets. The second term was really about, now that the foundation is in place, well, how do we put the structure around that? And in my view, the third term is all really about how do you start accelerating and fitting it all out? And I think that's why I think India will... Oh, it's got a good chance to actually not just say it's an expensive market and there's potential for reversals, but actually a point of actually accelerating growth. And actually, if you want to put it into proper context, India did go through a period where actually there was a lost decade. Post the global financial crisis in 2008, 2018, whilst economic growth was okay, there was a massive miss on the investment infrastructure side, where actually for those of us that kind of travel there often enough, you kind of saw no real infrastructure development. And it's the last 5 or 6 years where that started to reaccelerate, or last 2 or 3 years where that started to reaccelerate.
And obviously, China's had the big property issues with the debt. How's India funding this big infrastructure spend? Have you got the same concerns over the debt side of things, or are they doing it in a different way?
Firstly, they're not doing it. They're not, accelerating the way that China did, and also they. The global financial crisis is still relatively fresh in the minds of Indian corporates. And that was, as much as that was a developed world issue, actually, there was quite that sort of huge consolidation in infrastructure and property companies in India. And there were a lot of over-levered institutions and industries then. So actually, as this cycle has only really started, we're starting seeing the early signs of growth in both property and infrastructure and industrials. But we haven't got the excesses. And I think the government, again, going back to our yields and our inflation, the government wants to have a much more managed growth rate. The fiscal situation means that they can do that better. India's now got into bond indices as well, so that helps with the funding side.
Interesting.
You've got equity investors that are continuing to commit capital. So the government balance sheet looks a much better place now to cope with potential external shocks if they were to come up.
They sort of learn from others' mistakes in a way, and
others' mistakes as well as their own, right?
Of course, I
certainly don't want to sit here and go they've done everything right through history. I mean, they've made mistakes as well, and some of it's become less reliant on external factors. Some has been obviously a correction to being a more sustainable growth economy.
Sure.
And what does the stock market look like in terms of sort of sector composition and types of stocks, and how does that compare to the rest of emerging markets? Because my understanding is it does look quite different to a lot of emerging market indices, particularly China.
Yeah, so it looks different and it's been evolving. So that 8-20% move that I talked about doesn't come from just the same companies becoming bigger weights. It actually comes from newer and newer or more and more companies getting added to the index. So India, I guess, traditionally was very much about financials, IT services, and to some extent, consumers. Those were the three big sectors. Mm-hmm. You had a bit of energy that came in as well through companies like Reliance Industries and whatnot. But actually, those were the three big clusters. Actually, it's becoming much more diversified. Financials are still a big part of the market.
Mm-hmm.
We still like those. IT services are still another relatively large segment of the market. But actually, they're not the India growth story of the next 2 decades. They were the India growth story of the prior 2 decades. Consumers still, I think, has got a great opportunity, but actually the bigger opportunities will come maybe on the discretionary side rather than the staples side, where actually the impulse for spending, the growth in the middle class is all going to allow that to happen a lot more. And then I guess lastly, and I guess to your chart up here, you can see what's happening on the left-hand side.
Yeah, I really like this left-hand chart, actually, which is why I've just put it up.
And
this is the sort of the evolution of the proportion of earners in each category from low to high, for those listening, not watching. And as you can see, as time goes by, there's more people in those middle to upper income brackets than there are at the lower end of the income bracket. And I think the lower end here is sub $4,000. Is that right? Yes, yep. And then lower mid is sub $8,000, and then upper mid is kind of $18,000, and then above that. So it's a really good visual in terms of over the years from 2005 through to 2030 on a forecast basis, you know, people moving up that income spectrum. And as they do that, what do? They buy toothpaste, they buy a beer, they buy, you cars, know, cars, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Sorry. So, and that's a really good way of thinking about it, which comes back to your point about how the market's developed from, you know, financials into consumer stress, discretionary staples, that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. And excuse the pun, but you can actually see, you know, the belly expanding quite significantly, right? And as you said, actually what you're spending as you go from low to lower mid is very different to as you go from lower mid to upper mid, right? Yeah. So this is where the discretionary side becomes much more important. So whether that's two-wheelers, four-wheelers, jewellery, whether it's convenience, the factors that matter to you as a consumer change as each of those upper segments start to expand. And so I think India's going through that. And, you know, 2030 is not that far away now, right? We're only 5 years away from that point in time. And actually you can see the 2005 to 18 saw quite a big change. And I think we just carry on that journey now. Mm. And that's why I think, you know, we're looking, you know, for businesses that cater to air travel rather than, as you said, rather than just toothpaste or you know, products that Nestle produce, like noodles or whatever that might be, right? It's more about where is the next level of customer going to spend. And financials doesn't mean that financials are out of the picture. You maybe you don't need the most basic element of deposits, but now you need a credit card.
Credit card, life insurance, mortgage. Yeah, exactly. And you move up through the spectrum and you start taking on more and more financial services, don't you?
Absolutely.
Certainly that's the bull case for, you know, Prudential, for instance, here listed in the UK, but obviously big Asian arm. No, that's really good stuff. So what is it sort of, so it's a lot more consumer financials these days in the market. And I do have a chart here on valuation, which is we'd said we'd come back to.
Yes.
And it's kind of fair to say that Indian equities, you know, you wouldn't describe them as cheap, right? So I've only got MSCI India here, data from Datastream.
Yes.
Puts it on about 23, 24 times that. Is that feel about right on a sort of forward basis?
Yeah, as a broader market. The other bits we didn't talk about was obviously the markets, the other parts that's grown quite rapidly as a market, and what the consumers want is the platform type businesses that we all get quite used to over here, right? We get used to the Amazons and the Deliveroos, etc.
Sure.
But like these business models didn't really exist 2 or 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and they now are part of the mainstay in the market. Mm-hmm. So you've had that part of the market that becomes an investable opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the industrial side, which is being propelled by what's happening mm-hmm. on the infrastructure side. So I think there's lots of opportunities. Absolutely right. If you look at the sort of headline valuations, and these valuations, particularly when you start putting them relative to other EM economies, start to make it look like more of an outlier.
Yeah.
But as an individual economy, I think there is good, I mean, we talked about it, right? There's really reasons why actually the valuation and the valuation, to some extent, the re-rating is justified because the outlook for growth has got a lot better, a lot more visible, a lot more predictable. And what do markets want? They want predictability of growth. And if you can see predictability of growth, you're going to pay more for it.
Yeah, well, our tech analyst always talks about a runway for growth. How big is a runway for growth? You know, are you going to grow for two, three years at this speed? Or actually, do you have 5 or 10 years?
Yeah.
And if you think about the building blocks that we've already talked about, the demographics and the balance sheet and the growth, then clearly the runway is pretty big, right?
Yeah, so the runway is big, broad, deep. So it's got all the right aspects. Mm-hmm. Obviously, execution plays a massive role in all these things. It always has. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the only real disappointment, I think those of us that have been investing in these markets in India for a very long period of time would be actually they haven't really executed to the potential that they have. And again, I go back to since the BJP came in, actually the execution machine has actually got a lot better. So I would say 5, 10, 15, 20 years is probably what you can look out for and say economically they can do 6% real for that period of time.
Yeah.
And at some points markets will get a little bit expensive, a little bit cheap, but actually I don't look at this at an overall market level and go, it's a terribly expensive market. And for us as investors, even within expensive markets, there's always going to be stock opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what we're focusing on. Yeah. And there are definitely areas which feel a little bit frothy, particularly some of the small and mid-cap parts of the market where mm-hmm. I think there's been a bit more, where the retail has been a little bit more dominant there. Okay. And that's less fundamentally driven. So you want to be a bit cautious about certain parts of it, but not I wouldn't say university. I don't think I'm that worried.
There are lots of IPOs still coming to, because I think probably a year ago or so, there were lots of, got a number of quite exciting tech IPOs that sort of went quite ballistic in terms of prices. Is that still happening, or is that cooled off a bit?
No, they did, but they did a lot of what typically happens around everywhere in the world. They come at the top of the market, right? Or top of that part of the market. And then actually for most of these tech companies, they listed, they got it away. And then, you know, as the rate cycle around the world changed, some of them were down 60, 70%. Okay. So it's, I mean, in that way, India's quite a normal market. You do see those kind of, you know, when there is excesses, they do get punished. And sometimes you can't see what the reason for that's going to be. But then actually coming out of the last year or so, some of these businesses have recovered. They started to become, you know, the unprofitable growth businesses got punished. But as they've come out the cycle and become profitable growth businesses, you're starting to see a bigger opportunity and investor appetite come back there. But the IPO pipeline is probably now become more, there's more and more of it happening now than there probably was even in that earlier period. So I think now we're definitely seeing more companies come. The breadth of those companies, it's all across, you know, from healthcare to more platforms to more consumer to finance. It, you're pretty much seeing every industry coming to the market, which is
you
great.
As a team, are you taking part in those IPOs? Or
so I guess my general view about IPOs has been, there's always a, it's the one point there's a sort of an information disadvantage significantly for investors. So it's great to be able to meet companies, meet the key people, because that's the time they're trying to sell their business. And so we use these opportunities to really get to know businesses. I'm very reluctant. I rarely do IPOs because, as I said, I think there's just the point where you just have less history. And two, there is definitely a information disadvantage as an investor.
So I
generally want to see businesses kind of, I think listing and having external shareholders is very, very different to running a private business. And actually some of that's just, you know, having to speak to more people and having people's voices come up and
stakeholders.
Exactly. So we just want to see how they deliver for a little while before we invest.
And having visibility over your business as well, having to do quarterly earnings reports, you know, sometimes as a business, it's quite good not telling the rest of the world what you're doing from a strategy perspective and telling what your competitors what you're doing. So I often think that that is, it can be quite difficult for a lot of particularly private investors or private owners of businesses to come to the market.
Well, I'd say absolutely, and particularly if it's been very entrepreneurial driven, to have other shareholders then telling you how they think you should run your business, I think is quite a challenge to have to deal with that. So yeah, there are adjustments, but it just means that you've got a bit of time to get to know these businesses.
Couple of stock examples. I don't think we're going to put this up because it's quite a busy slide, but do you want to talk us through, we've got Hindustan Unilever here. Do you want to sort of give us a bit of background about the stock, the company, and why you like them and why you've got them in the portfolio?
Yeah, look, it's one business, so Unilever's subsidiary in India. So it's a business we've known and owned for a very long period of time. We think it does, you know, a lot of things well, particularly when we talked about that first stage and shift in the consumer pyramid. They already had products for the market. They had a very strong management team. They have sort of unparalleled distribution advantage. And again, for those that have been to India, you'll know that actually it's not easy. You're not going to get consumers just walking into your door to buy, you know, shampoos or noodles.
Distribution is really difficult in India because it's geographically not easy to get around, right? But it can be quite...
Absolutely. So the companies that have done well in the last two decades, those that have actually invested in having big, deep distribution, and that doesn't mean just tier one cities, it's the ones that have got distribution arms and investments in tier two, tier three, tier four.
Because it's not glamorous, right? You're talking about like vans and lorries and like guys driving up country roads to get to the kind of more remote areas. And that does take a lot of investment, a lot of time.
Yeah.
And this comes back to kind of Warren Buffett's things about moats, you know. It's all very well doing it in France or the UK. It's relatively small with a good road network, but it's very different, I imagine, in India.
Yeah, and you have to adjust your products to having, if you're going to be selling in tier four cities, they're not buying the full size products. So you have to create sachets. So you have to start creating not just the distribution, but the products.
Right,
And obviously, once you get consumers in that tier four cities, as the wealth effect kicks in, as those start migrating up the pyramid, you're starting to build a level of brand loyalty. They've used your products, etc. Yeah. And that's, I mean, companies like Colgate have done that very well in India. As I said, Hindustan Unilever has done that very well. I mean, obviously, both of those companies I just mentioned do benefit quite a lot from strong parentage and strong product pipeline. So they're able to, you know, cater to the market as the market comes to them. And they've been led by, I guess, very strong management teams there as well. So I think it captures the kind of every bits of what we're looking for. It's a high return on capital business. So it's got great economics. It generates lots of cash flow. It pays you a dividend. So those are the kind of good economic side you're looking for. But like we talked about before, it's got the visibility and the sustainability of growth and duration. Now, is it a business that's going to grow 30%, 40%? No, but it will continue to chug along growing probably, you know, low double digits, but can do that for a very long period of time.
And what sort of valuations on that these days?
So again, the headline multiple for this kind of business is, again, the challenging bit. So it's, you know, it's around 50-ish times earnings. And so, you know, do you want to have a lot of money there? No, yeah, but do you want to still have some exposure to that?
Is it a big index weight?
It's a reasonable index weight. It's not the large, it's not in the sort of largest names in the index, but we tried to be a little bit more aware rather than positioning against the benchmark sort of very systematically.
Does India have a problem with benchmark weightings in the same way that the UK traditionally does, but of course now the US does as well? Does it have big index constituents that are driving the headline index? Is that not a concern? Is that something you have to navigate?
There are certain names that are very big in the index. And so we try and navigate those that if it is a material part of the index and we think we should have some exposure to it. So we're not just taking, by having nothing in it, we're not just taking a sort of single stock bet that dominates all the other risks in the portfolio. So there is a bit of management and portfolio construction around that. It's not as, so there's probably two or three names that are very significant that you have to have some view around whether, you know, whether you want to be overweight. And if you want to be underweight, maybe zero is not the right number you want, but you can manage that in terms of from a
risk. Yeah, we have it in the UK with BP, Shell and AstraZeneca, or certainly Shell and Astra, HSBC are all 7-8% positions.
Right.
We know what's happening in the US, Apple, Microsoft and NVIDIA now, what, 6 or 7% of positions?
Right.
So you need to be really mindful of that when you're putting portfolios together, because, you know, as I always sort of say to people, we don't always know what the future's going to hold. We can take a view and we think it might be overvalued or we think that it's too rich, but we can't necessarily not earn it because we might be wrong. And the market, you know, the market might have a different view. So that's interesting, interesting to know. And then any other sort of stocks you want to talk about? What about something in the financial space? Have you got any banks in the portfolio, for instance?
Yeah, so we have a lot of private sector banks, actually. Mm-hmm. And they go from, you know, names that you know very well, so the ICICI banks, the Kotak Mahindras, the HDFC banks. We also have quite a lot when you go into the financials. We have some housing finance companies. Okay. We have some non-banking financial companies, and I think actually all of these businesses, which sound all like typical financials, actually do serve a very different customer. Mm-hmm. So actually, you are getting exposure to different parts of it. The big private sector banks are very much dealing with the more affluent end. If you're a housing finance company, you're actually dealing with the bottom of the pyramid.
Yeah.
But again, you're lending against property. So whilst you're, in theory, lending to some riskier segments of the market, I mean, the likelihood of people defaulting on your property is probably the lowest risk segment. And then you've got other businesses that are lending to vehicles or used cars or commercial vehicles. So actually across the financials, or at least the banking side, we have pretty broad exposure there. And then we have other financials in, you know, asset management businesses, insurance companies, where again, when you start with the top down is that in all of these segments, under-penetration is the starting point.
Yeah.
There is market share opportunities. There's consolidation opportunities. And it's not all going to be in a straight line. But we do think actually as a sector, there is still quite a lot of long-term growth opportunity and a long runway ahead.
Mm. And what is the proportion of financials in the market these days? As a proportion of the, roughly?
I think the numbers would be somewhere around 20%.
20% market. Where is it?
You
know, financials.
You can see on that slide our exposure is on the far left, right?
Yeah. So 4.5 overweight.
Yeah.
So it's about 22% of the market.
I was going to ask you about fund positioning versus market. So that slide up there. The screen is quite interesting. So that's, as you said before, you've got the overweight to consumer discretionary, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then big underweights to utilities, energy,
telecoms, essentially, isn't it? The traditionally boring stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. It ties up with the stuff that I've been saying. It'd be funny if I helped out there. Everything I said, then you pull over this chart and I'm overweight utilities and energy. So,
just a trading position.
Yes, exactly. So, look, I talked about the reasons that, you know, we think discretionary has a long-term opportunity, and we have been moving more and more towards that, as I said, that whether that's two-wheelers or whether that's four-wheelers or autos, SUVs, etc. So we do have more exposure there. Financial's been pretty long-standing. We still like the segments there. Staples has actually come down a bit because actually between the consumer side, we do want to have more in the discretionary side. And the industrial side is really much leveraging where we think the economic and the investment cycle for the economy is going to go. We actually would like to have quite a bit more in the industrial space. But that's where, to your earlier question around valuations, that's where valuations do strike a very big divergence in opportunities and the way we'd love to own some of these businesses. But there are times where actually great businesses are just overvalued and you just need to be patient. So it's more about being patient, not that we can't find businesses there.
Is there big electric vehicle growth in India, and are Indian names playing that, or is it kind of the Chinese EV makers?
No, I mean, yes, there is a big opportunity. I mean, the challenge, even same challenges we have in the developed world, which is infrastructure. Mm. Obviously, it's magnified a million times in markets like India, where even in top-tier cities, you don't have, I guess, the charging's and the infrastructure around that is more difficult. But you've got very big investments happening by some of the big conglomerates, particularly like the Tata Group companies on the EV side. And you know, some of those investments are making them the leading EV company in the country. Yeah, right. And so, you know, they're on a journey. I wouldn't say it's complete. So they're on a journey there. And I think actually, again, when you listen to the government, the idea of renewables, EVs and that area of investments is very high up the BJP's agenda or Modi's government's agenda.
But India is quite a big net importer of fossil fuels for its energy needs, right? So it always gets whipped around by the oil price a little bit.
Yes, historically. And it's been able to manage that much better in the more recent past. And again, I think part of the government's agenda is aligned to exactly what you just said. They want to be less vulnerable to those external shocks. And oil has been the area of external shock and vulnerability, and because it brings in, imports a lot of inflation into the economy. So the more that they can do on the green energy side, reducing the needs on imported oil and coal, etc., the quicker they get to not having to deal with those external shocks. So that's definitely big on their agenda.
I think that's one thing that we've talked about quite a lot on the podcast is the world becoming a more dangerous place, a little bit more splintered, not just natural resources being one obvious area, war in Ukraine, you know, Russian oil and gas, etc., but also on the sort of trade side of things, China, US, potentially going to something resembling a Cold War, Trump tariffs, you know, we just don't know. And it's, you know, it's no surprise to hear that the Indian government is saying, well, we need to be less reliant on the world for our natural resources, our energy, otherwise you're at the behest of what happens in the world, right?
Like, I guess on what's going on with the tariffs against China, is India a big beneficiary of that?
Yeah, so look, we talked about one side, which was energy security, but the other side has been the manufacturing boon. And again, it's an area that some of these things that I talk about makes the government look like they've had some strokes of geniuses. And actually, the reality is that some of it's just kind of landed on their lap. And great, because they, you know, they weren't playing for it. They were playing for things they can control. Yeah. And they've done a good job in that. But actually, it's the other stuff that when it has presented itself, they've been also being able to take the opportunity. So they have put in schemes to attract foreign investors more. So you're right, to the point that I guess companies have become more and more aware of the single country risk they had from sourcing. And they knew about it for a long period of time, but they didn't worry about it to the same extent that they have in the last few years. And then it's about, okay, if we need to diversify sourcing, where are we going to diversify it? And actually, when you start looking around the world, you need property, land, labor, water. And there's very few other places with the abundance of all of those to be able to do it. So that's the area that's actually been actually a massive windfall that I don't think, you know, the government 2 terms ago would have said that's what we're playing towards. It's just come. So all the big companies, Apple, Tesla,
I was going to ask about Apple, because don't 10% of their iPhones now produced in India?
Yeah.
It's gone up a number of X percentage over the last few years.
Yeah, but actually that's, I mean, that in a sense, that's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Because what that's done is given confidence to other corporates to say, well, if Apple's happy doing it, we should be happy doing it. And that's, so I think there's been quite a lot that's come in there. So the manufacturing sector is seeing a boon. We're seeing things like, again, connected to that industry, electronic manufacturing services growing rapidly. And as I said, the government is then recognising this is happening. Well, we're going to provide schemes that give you tax benefits for making those investments.
Mm.
So maybe these are not great industries globally. So how do we get corporates to invest in them? So actually all of this benefit that people are looking for, we can provide. So there are subsidies that the government's providing to say, look, you put the investments in, we'll cover some element of that,
which means
your return on investment is attractive enough for you to invest.
Yep.
And that becomes circular, right? Because if it works, the government will get the payback on it because it will attract a lot more investment. And then the companies will also make the returns on their investment, which makes it. So it just becomes quite a circular event. Yeah,
for sure. No, that's interesting. Anything from you, Husey, before we wrap it up? It's a deep sigh.
I mean, I guess around, there's so much going on, it all sounds very positive. I mean, it's kind of two questions. One is, you know, the way we usually allocate to EM is to an EM fund manager. Do you think, you know, now's the time to start having a bit more country specific exposure?
Mm.
And secondly, you know, what can go wrong?
Okay, so two very different questions. Look, I think the idea of sort of single country allocations and funds, you know, there is, you know, over time these questions come up and down, and I think back to like 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of single country funds, and then there was a move back to sort of regional and EM type funds. And again, in the last 4 or 5 years, particularly around China, we went around that question around whether that deserves an allocation on its own. I think big economies over time, I think, start justifying their own allocation. And also they become, you know, less connected to what's happening in other parts of the market. But when economies are quite small and liquidity becomes an issue, then I think the ability to allocate through just single countries is much more challenging from an investor perspective. As economies broaden, become more, or start developing a lot more, as liquidity profiles start to improve, single country allocations become make a lot more sense, become a lot more economical. And there's a broader opportunity set. You're not, I mean, places like China and India are not actually reliant on one industry, right? So you're not, if you're investing in that economy, you're not investing just in a sector, where certain economies are still very reliant on, maybe it's commodities or energy. And so you're taking commodity view or energy
view. You know, it wasn't that long ago where the biggest stocks in the emerging markets index were Chinese state-owned banks, Gazprom, the Russian oil producer, and Petrobras in Brazil. Well, you know, that's quite a funky portfolio with the best will in the world.
Chinese state-owned enterprises.
Chinese state-owned, exactly.
And to, I mean, to your second question, I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Well, if I knew, look, I don't know. The only thing I would say is that, well, you know, this is where the valuation sensitivity, you've got to be sort of careful around what you're investing in. I think, you know, there's always potential external shocks that you need to be aware and wary of. And that's, you know, India still runs a current account deficit. It's not very high. It's not like it used to be, but it still does. You never know with, you know, geopolitics, anything could happen. So I think you still need to be aware of those. I think in all the traditional aspects of what India's had in terms of vulnerabilities and risks, actually it's improved on every count of those. So I think the vulnerabilities are much lower, but the valuations are also much higher. So I guess the biggest vulnerability is that, you know, things look a little bit more expensive. Yeah. Can India grow into that quite quickly? I think so.
I think that's the key, isn't it? You know, growing into those valuations, and as long as there's not a black swan event or some sort of geopolitical risk that we, you know, can't predict, then actually there's a big opportunity there.
Yeah, I think the economic setup is, I think, probably as good as I think ever really seen it in India. And you know, the market, the reason that you've seen that dispersion in market returns is that, you know, investors are seeing that as well. The only thing, the last point I was making, I made it right at the beginning, was the big change is the domestic investors, investor base, and, you know, how much they've been sort of competing with foreign capital, but also being the drivers of the market rather than foreigners. And that's been a sea change over the last.
I guess they're way less valuation sensitive in terms of what they're buying. They're less sophisticated. And
absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's, I guess there is more of a momentum-driven market. Yeah. Also momentum-driven, stocks-driven by that. That's why you see a little bit more of, in the smaller mid-cap space, a big gap in terms of valuation between the large caps. So we do still see a lot of value in some of those large cap areas versus the smaller mid-caps. Some of the small mid-caps have some really exciting stories. We just want to be a bit more sensitive around the valuations.
That's great. Well, we'll wrap it up there, I think. That's been very interesting, Amit. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week. And any questions, let us know. He's james.hughes@courtachievit.com and I'm jonathan.raymond@courtachievit.com. And we'll hope to see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thanks.